Good afternoon. My name is David W., and I'm from I'm an alcoholic. From Wilmington, North Carolina. We're kind of slow in Wilmington, North Carolina. But we are here. And I'm excited to be here. I am definitely honored to be asked to speak here this afternoon. I want to thank my delegate for nominating me, and thank the selection committee at General Service for selecting me for this. This is definitely an honor and a privilege. I'm deeply humbled, and I want to thank you for being here and allowing me to speak and take up 20 minutes of your life and share with you about corrections, something that I'm very passionate about, and you'll understand why as I get a little bit further along in my story. A little bit of housekeeping to start off with. My sobriety date is December the 6th, 1994. Thank you. I owe that all to you and the grace of God and a power greater than myself. My home group is Jaywalkers Group. That's right. The Jaywalkers Group of Wilmington, North Carolina, is a hardcore big book study group, and we got our name right out of the book itself. So, you know, we are the Jaywalkers, and there's some of us represented here tonight, and I appreciate that as well. And I've got a sponsor. You know, and those are the things that kind of keep me grounded today. You know, a sobriety date, a sponsor, and a home group where I can be held accountable. And that's what my sobriety is based on. Now, I was asked to share today on challenges in corrections. And my name is David, and I am a challenge. I was a challenge in corrections. So they've got the right person here. You know, it never ceases to amaze me how God works in my life. You know, I was asked by my delegate a little over a year ago if I would mind chairing a meeting at the International Convention. And I thought to myself, yes, that would be awesome, an honor to do that and give some service to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I could never repay you for everything you've done for me. And so I said yes right off the bat. I would love to be considered to chair a meeting at the International Convention. And so time went on. I registered. I got my plans together, got my affairs in order and everything, and then I get an email. Now, let me give you a bit of suggestion. Do not read emails from the International Convention Selection Committee while drinking water or any other beverage. Just a little heads up there. So I'm reading, and the subject comes across the top of the screen and says, you know, invitation to chair or share in a meeting. And so I'm still safe there. The subject's still safe. I read a little bit further and says, David, you've been selected to, this is an invitation to share your story at a meeting. That's when the liquid came back up into my throat. And here I am, and I am grateful to be here today, and I hope that, you know, you will receive some of that passion that I have for corrections. If you're not in corrections, or if you have questions about corrections, that you will get something out of this that you can carry back to and use in your own sobriety, in your own corrections work. Like I said, I was a challenge in corrections. If it had not been for corrections work, I probably would not be standing here today. I am a product of the North Carolina Charm School for Men. I've lived in a few gated communities myself. And I am grateful that I don't have to live there today. I do occasionally visit, and that's a choice that I make. A little bit about my drinking to start off with, so that you know that I qualify. There's three drinks in my life that I will always remember. That's my first one, my first actual drunk, and then my last one. Now, the first one came when I was 3 years old. I was having the typical three-year-old day. Nothing was going my way. I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I was out with the family, which I didn't really want to be there, and it was getting close to evening time, and I had things to do. And so we were out at a restaurant, and I was drinking the typical milk beverage that the typical three-year-old would normally drink, and I did not want that. I wanted the nice umbrella drinks that my parents were drinking, and their friends were drinking. And so I tried to get to those, and they wouldn't let me have them. But then one of my dad's friends realized that maybe if we give him a little bit of these umbrella drinks, that it might calm him down a little bit, and we can manage him and put him off to bed. So they did. And what I realized today is that, being the typical alcoholic that I am, alcohol does not react in my body like it does in other people's body. What they hoped for did not happen. What happened was, I had slithered out of my high chair and proceeded to run around the restaurant, flapping my wings, jumping up and down, and telling everybody that I could fly. I was quickly apprehended, charged with public disorder, drunk in public, and sentenced to my crib for the rest of that evening. Now, I should have got used to that view, because as my drinking progressed, I saw that view a lot. And so that's how it began. And then a few years later, I actually took my first drunk. And that was important, because that's when the committee stopped and alcohol worked. And I crossed that line into alcoholism that I know today. And I always was an alcoholic, but I became an actively practicing alcoholic. Because I knew that because that alcohol had that magic to make everything okay, to bring the world together, to make me feel whole, that I had to have that as a part of my life. And I proceeded to drink, and I proceeded to incorporate alcohol into my life on a regular basis. Now, just as I was when I was three, consequences followed quickly with my drinking. And a lot of people began to realize that I had a problem with my drinking long before I realized I had a problem with my drinking. My parents realized I had a problem with my drinking. The school realized I had a problem with my drinking. The state of Georgia realized I had a problem with my drinking. The state of South Carolina realized I had a problem with my drinking. The state of North Carolina realized I had a problem with my drinking. And then I began to realize that I had a problem with my drinking. My last drink, I woke up on a Monday morning after doing who knows what in and out of a blackout, and reached over to the nightstand where I had just a little bit of alcohol left, because I needed something to quiet the voices and calm the nerves before I tried to proceed to go into work that morning. And when I took that drink, something happened. Nothing happened. And I realized that alcohol had stopped working. The voices were still there. The uncomfortable feeling of being less than and not good enough was still there. And alcohol did not take those away. So I did the next right thing that a good old alcoholic like myself would do. I proceeded to go out and get more alcohol to make it work. And I did. And I hear oftentimes in these meetings that people will share that they were drunk from the neck down. And that's what happened with me that day. I proceeded to continue to drink, trying to find more alcohol and more alcohol and more alcohol to put into my body to try to make it work. And it didn't. It would not work anymore. And despite all that I did that day, it would not work. And by the grace of God, I got arrested that afternoon and probably saved my life, because I probably would have drank myself to death trying to make alcohol work that day. And coming through the next day on that December 6th, I woke up and tried to piece everything together and figure out what was going on with my life, because I did not understand how I could be in and out of jails and prisons, and come from a good family that loved me to death, that didn't want anything else to do with me anymore, and friends that had turned their back, and promising careers that I've torn down, and here I was again faced with a lot of time and sitting in jail and not knowing where to go. And I didn't know what to do, and I was scared. I was in the place that the book says, the jumping off place, and I didn't know what to do. All I wanted was the end. And I was in a point where I was too afraid to kill myself, but too afraid to keep living. And I went through the whole process of court. I went through and got sentenced, and then it was off to jail, off to prison again for the fifth time in in North Carolina. And, you know, looking back, I'm 24 years old, and I had spent most of my adult life to that point behind bars in one form or another. You know, I grew up in the prison system, and I just thought that was the way it was supposed to be. That was my life, you know, in and out. Now, I didn't wake up every morning and say, you know what, let me see what I can do today to go off to prison. Trust me, I didn't. But I did pick up that drink, and when I did that, who knows where I would end up. And most of the time, it was being hauled off to jail, which would lead me to prison or corrections. And so here I was again going off, you know, and this time it was a little bit different because there was nothing to look forward to. All the other times, I would look forward to getting out because I knew when I got out, I could drink again. That was the reward for doing my time. I go to jail, I do my time, I get healthy, and then I go drink. This time I knew it didn't work that way because alcohol had stopped working. I had nothing to look forward to. I was at the end. And I can remember sitting on that bus, headed off to prison. And they were sending me to a camp called Cresswell, which is at the far reaches of North Carolina. Now, you can't see the end of the world. It's not the end of the world, but you can see the end of the world from there. And that's just where they were taking me. And it's like a two bus, a van, and a car ride just to get out to this prison camp. And I'm headed out there, and I'm sitting there. Now, every time I take this trip, because I've taken it many times, not to the specific camp, but to a camp, there's always some things that go through my mind. One, who I need to call first to send me some money. Two, make sure that my paperwork gets there correctly so that I don't spend a day longer in here than I need to. Three, who I'm going to call to visit me. And all the other things that go through my mind. This time it was different. This time, all I thought about as I passed that swampland and those woods on both sides of the road was that I hope and pray that they find a deep enough hole to drop me in and they can forget about me and I can disappear. Because that's all that I wanted to do. I just wanted to disappear. Like I said, I was too scared to kill myself and I did not want to keep living. Just take me away, drop me in a hole, and forget about me. And they took me away, and they dropped me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to that prison camp that night, and then just in time to make my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And there was members from Alcoholics Anonymous in the community that had brought a meeting into that prison. And they did it regularly, and I was there that night. Now, I don't know. Well, I take that back. I'm pretty sure that I probably would have never found Alcoholics Anonymous on the streets. I'm pretty sure, because I really didn't stay on the streets long enough to look for it. So it's a good thing you came to where I was at. And that's the way it is with a lot of us. We don't have enough time on the street to go looking for Alcoholics Anonymous. So Alcoholics Anonymous has to come to where we're at. And you did. And you were there that night. And the beautiful thing about it is that whoever brought that meeting in, it was a speaker meeting, whoever brought that meeting in that night knew how to bring a meeting in to a correctional facility. And all they did was tell their story. And that's all they had to do. They did not have to talk down to me because I was a convict, a criminal. They didn't have to make up stories that weren't true. They didn't have to cuss and curse. They represented Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got the same Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that I would have gotten if I walked into any church, clubhouse, or fire station on the streets as a free person. And I'm so grateful for that because I didn't get anything else and nothing else would have worked. I got AA when I needed AA. But like I said, I was a challenge. Sometimes still am. And I didn't really see the need. I loved the story. It was beautiful, moving. I knew that this was where I needed to be, but I didn't think it would work for me. Plus, I figured since I had so much time that I had some time. I didn't need to do anything right away. Let's not be too drastic about this thing here. Let's take our time and think this thing through. You know what I'm saying? I've got a few years here. Y'all seem to come back on a regular basis. Maybe I'll catch you out next time. You know what I'm saying? So I thought I would sit back and think about it. And from my experience, you know, the common mentality is, my personal and others that I've come in contact when doing corrections work, is that, you know, I don't really need to start right away. I can get me a sponsor when I get out. I can start working the steps when I get out. When I get out, it's too late. When I get out, I'm a dead man walking. Because what you told me was that the same man will drink again. Now, all the times that I've gone to prison before and gone to jail and gotten locked up before, as soon as I walk through the gate and the gate shuts behind me, I've changed. I start writing those letters. I've changed, baby. Things are going to be different now. Mom, Dad, I'm a new person. And nothing has changed. And I had that same mentality that last time, but you told me that the same man will drink again. And my experience proved that. Because all those other times, even though I thought I had changed, I had not changed. And nothing changed, and I would get out, and I'd go right back to doing what I was doing before. Sometimes I'd be in jail. This is the picture of insanity. I'd be sitting in jail trying to figure out how I could do the exact same thing that I just got locked up for and not get caught the next time. So I knew that wasn't going to work. But I was still stubborn. And a guy told me one time, he said, David, do what these people tell you to do. Get a sponsor, work the steps, go to meetings. Prove to me that this program will not work for you. And I've been doing that for the last 20 years. I know this program works flawlessly in prison and outside of prison. And thinking that I don't need to start when I do inside of prison, I am sadly mistaken, because that's the true test of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous for me isn't about not drinking. My first sponsor said not drinking is a prerequisite to Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is about change, changing who I am, changing the person that I am, and where better to put to the test the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous than a place where the culture is right is wrong and wrong is right. Doing good is bad and doing bad is good. That's the culture of a prison. You're looked down upon, your peers look down upon you when you try to do the right thing for the right reason. Practicing Alcoholics Anonymous principles, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous principles in a prison environment is the true test of Alcoholics Anonymous. People say, oh, it's easy to stay sober in prison. It might be easy to stay away from a drink in prison, but try practicing honesty, integrity. Try getting down on your knees every day and praying in a prison. It's not that easy to practice those principles. Those are the challenges that there are. It's trying to get somebody to see that it is important, imperative, essential that they start working this program from the beginning in a prison. Because if they wait till the time that they get out, like I said, they are a dead man walking. Because the same man will drink again. There is no difference between a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in prison and a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in any church or clubhouse on the street. There should not be. And I've been to some very, very fine meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in prison. You know? And I'm so grateful that they're there. You know, my whole time I spent was in meetings, in corrections and meetings. And in some institutions, the only way that I could have a meeting was if you brought one to me. So it was imperative that you showed up. Consistency, my sobriety depended on your consistency. My sobriety depended on you being accountable, you being a fine member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when you didn't show up, I didn't have a meeting. And that was probably the only meeting I was going to get that week. And I needed my meetings. And you showed up. Time after time, you showed up. Holidays, you showed up. Rainy days, you showed up. You were there. You brought that message of hope into me, into a guy like me. You know, I took off into this program, and I worked the steps, and I did all the things that I'm supposed to do. But my perception is a little twisted. That's not really funny. My perception is a little twisted, and I don't always hear and see things the way I'm supposed to. And I would hear things that my sponsor would tell me, you know, you need to work the steps, you need to change and all this. And I thought that a lot of that stuff had happened while I was going through the program. And I get through the 12 steps. I'm doing the 4-step. I'm doing the 12 steps. I'm working with my sponsor, and I have a spiritual awakening. And as a result of the spiritual awakening, I begin to practice these principles in all your affairs. I could take your inventory faster than a speeding bullet. Catch a resentment faster than a locomotive. And I did not realize that the practicing that I was doing was nothing more than the information collected in my head and not doing the stuff that I needed to do to bring it down 6 inches to my heart. I had to embody this program and not just give it lip service. See, I read the book. Mighty fine book, too. I read the book and I was able to quote the book, page, number, and paragraph, because I had nothing but time. So I was going to be a scholar on big book. I was a big book scholar. And I never really lived it. I never really did anything. And when I got out of prison 3.5, 4 years later from working the program and getting alcoholics, I did not pick up a drink. Thank God I did not pick up a drink. But everything else, fair game. And I proceeded to revert back to old behavior. And I realized today what my sponsor had tried to talk me a long time ago, and that this is not about not drinking. This is about change. You know, this isn't about not drinking. This is about change. And I had to change, and I just thought I had changed. And then as a result, I had to go back to prison. Now, I had to go back sober to prison after being out, after going through all that, because I had only thought that I changed. And I called my sponsor up, and my sponsor came back in and visited me. And he said, you know, David, when I told you that you needed to get back into prison, that's not what I had in mind. All right, thanks, Keith. I understand that. And he asked me, he says, so what's different this time? And I said, there's a lot different. I said, I really need to do the work. And this is the best place to do it. And this is the best place to practice it. I can't just wait till I get out to try to apply these things. I've got to do it now. And so I did that, you know, I did that, and I began to work this program with all diligence, you know, and I began to sponsor and give away. And everything that I did out here and do out here, I did in there, because it's the same. It's the same. I don't buy into that it's different in there. It's not different in there. It's no different than it is here in Atlanta, than it is in North Carolina, than it is in California. Yeah, there's autonomy, and we're all a little bit different, but the basic principles of Alcoholics Anonymous is true whether you're out here or you're in there. And for us to carry this, and for us to go in there thinking that it's different does them a disservice, did me a disservice. It will do them a disservice, because then they'll start thinking that they're different. And that's the worst thing for an alcoholic to do, is to think that he's different. Thinking that I'm different will get me killed. I'm just a garden variety drunk that got caught. That's it. But I'm still a drunk. I'm still just an alcoholic. Treat me as such. Whether I'm out here or in there, treat me just like another alcoholic, or else you take the chance of killing me. I go back today. Sometimes I'm able to carry my message, and for that I'm thoroughly grateful. I'm also grateful to be able to serve on committees and tell my story to corrections, to help impart others with the sensitivity of the issues that are involved in corrections work. You know, had it not been for that first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous in prison, like I said, I probably would not be standing here today. I probably would not have the gifts of sobriety that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And I have so many gifts today. And I'm not talking about material things. You know, one of the greatest things, one of the things that I wanted more than anything else when I was in prison, and I think I take the if you take, I think if you take a poll of everybody in prison, you'll find this consensus, is freedom. I wanted to get out. I think everybody in there does. And I would go to my sponsor and I'd say, when am I going to get out? Thought it was an important question. And he would look at me and he says, when you're ready to get out. I was like, well, when am I going to be ready to get out? Second important question. And he says, when you're out. These long timers, old timers, whatever you want to call them, not nice people. But the thing that I was looking for, I found not by getting out, but by going into the steps. I found that freedom because I had a misconception of what the definition of freedom was. The misconception that I had was I thought freedom was being able to do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. That's what I thought freedom was, being able to do, because in there I'm told what to do, when to do it, how to do it. And I wanted to do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. But you know what? That's the definition of self-centeredness, selfishness, which is the root of my problem. I misunderstood what the definition of freedom was. Freedom for me today that I found in prison was doing what I ought to do because I want to do it. Not because there's this officer over here making me do it. Not because you told me that I should do it. Because I want to do the next right thing. And what makes me want to do the next right thing today? Working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous has produced that psychic change that makes me want to do the next right thing. Am I perfect at it? No. But I try to the best of my ability, wake up each morning, suit up, and do the next right thing. And I started that in prison, in corrections. And I carry that message back into corrections. Now, it's not so fortunate that I can go into prisons and everything like I want to today. But the other challenge that is needed so badly is the connection for when people get out of prison. I am there when anybody reaches out their hand, reaches out the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when they reach out from prison. And if somebody released, that transition to getting back into society can be a difficult one. You're faced with challenges with family, employment, society looking down on you. They don't need Alcoholics Anonymous looking down on them, too. Like I said, they're just another alcoholic. I am there to help that alcoholic just like I am any other alcoholic. Pick them up, carry them to a meeting. Introduce them to my network, to my sponsor. Treat them just like they did if they walked in off the street. That's how I was treated. I was grateful enough that the support in the meetings that I had allowed me to be introduced to members of Alcoholics Anonymous in the community. So when I walked out that gate and I walked into my meeting, a free meeting outside of the prison, I knew most of the people in that meeting. And that's a wonderful feeling. That's a wonderful feeling. You know, there's a line in the Big Book, and I'm going to close with this. There's a line in the Big Book that I hold dearly today, and it's on page 100. I'm still quoting. And it says, you know, that you and the new man must walk day by day through the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen to you. When you look back, you'll see that the things that came to you when you put yourself in God's hands were better than anything you could have planned yourself. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances are. That's the promise of the 12th step. But that's also the promise of corrections on both sides. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, David. And our next speaker is Harold L. from St. Louis.
Hey, everybody. My name is Harold Long. I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be here. Be sober. Before I get started, there was a young lady that came up right before the meeting started from Florida, and she asked about a particular institution, if there was anybody here that carried message into that institution. I forget the name of the institution. It begins with a W. There she is. What is the name of it?
Walton Correction.
Yeah, so if you have any connection with anybody that's carried the message to the institution, her father, who's 80 years old, got the message carried to him, and she wants to pay her respects to whoever did that. So if you can meet with that young lady. Fantastic. Well, there's three types of people to come to A. There's those who make it happen, those who watch it happen, and those who don't know what's happening at all, right? And I've been all three of those cats. You know? But I know I'm in the room with a lot of make it happen people today, and that's awesome. My sobriety date's April 7, 1987. My home group is AA on the Rocks, St. Louis, Missouri, Wednesday night. If you come to St. Louis ever, if you get a hold of us ahead of time, my prison commitment's on Wednesday or Tuesday nights. I'd love to bring you out there and put you to work. And people love to hear from others besides me every week, you know. And some of you that are here have had the privilege to come into the institution where I'm at and do a lot of great work, and it's very appreciative. David, thank you for kicking us off. Wonderful testimony. Thank you for all those who are participating in corrections. My first AA meeting ever in my life was in a correctional facility in 1979. I didn't want anything to do with AA at that point in time. I was far from being one of you people, I can promise you that. I was a poor criminal, but the bad part about it was I grew up in the country and I had a name, Harold. And it was hard to be cool with that name, I'm just telling you. Because there wasn't very many of us, you know, I was pretty much the only one. So if you went to write like graffiti on the side of a bridge and wrote Harold, it finally dawned on you that, well, they're going to know it's you, you're the only one that can do it. So you have to go back and write sucks after it, you know. Pretty much, right out the gate. To cover your tail, you know what I'm saying? But I was a really poor criminal. I started a life of crime before I ever picked up a drink, I can promise you that. And I ended up, you know, the Missouri Department of Corrections got a hold of me quick. I started my journey in Boys Town, Missouri as a young chap, 12 years old. And as I was riding down the road in the car to go to Boys Town, Missouri, the committee was in the car counseling me on how bad my name was. And they're like, you know, you can't go to an all-guys institution with the name Harold. Man, the name Harold sucks. And I'm like, man, you're right, it does suck. And they're like, you can't use your middle name, that's Eugene. You can't use any of it. And you sure can't, you know, so you're going to have to change your name. So before I took that little hour and a half jaunt down 44, when I got there, I changed my name to Jeffrey Allen Long, and that's what my name stayed until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that's the power of 100 forms of fear, self-pity, and self-delusion driving your life. I mean, I promise you. But then I got in some more trouble, and I didn't have to worry about a name anymore. They gave me a number. Ha-ha. And I started a whole new journey. So that's where the message just carried me on the inside, and David gave a good, great testimony to that. I didn't find recovery inside the institution. It was the furthest thing I wanted anything to do. I always found my way back to it. Now, I have a big amends to make to the state of Georgia because I used to live in Georgia for a short time. I lived in Acworth, Georgia, where anybody knows where Acworth's at. We got a few people that survived that town. And I lived in Red Barn Trailer Court in Acworth, Georgia in the mid-80s. And I lived on a street that there wasn't anybody from Georgia living on my street. It was an island of it was a street full of rejects, all rednecks. It was kind of like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. If you remember that show, The Island of Misfit Toys? Yeah, that's what it was like on my street. And nobody wanted to be a Charlie in a box on my street either, I can promise you. But that was the deal. I lived next door to three guys named Porkchop, Screwdriver, and Hollywood. Here in Acworth. I hadn't been back to Acworth in all these years. And then just not too long ago, I was doing an AA commitment down in Florida, and we were going to go to the race down there on top of it. So we drove. And Susie went with me, and we got a chance to stop in Acworth and actually meet an old friend from there. And we ate at the Waffle House at midnight, and Acworth has changed a lot. If I owe anything to that, I spent a little time in jail in Acworth in Cobb County and all around there. But I didn't get sober there. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1987. I came in, and I had a 4 DWI conviction. A few weeks later, I was driving in a vehicle as a passenger, and we had a high-speed chase with another car that ended up in two people losing their life. And just a little bit after that, I was arrested for 50 WI, laying in jail, incarcerated, getting ready to go back to the penitentiary, 21 years old, in a whole lot of trouble. And in my underwear, on my knees, I said the greatest prayer I've ever said in my life, a prayer I've heard hundreds of thousands of times in AA, a three-word prayer was simply, God, help me, you know. And I said that prayer. Yeah, can't hear? That better? It's that southern drawl. I'm sorry about that. I figured. Oh, is it the crowd next door? Let's get him. But anyway, that was the case. And so I, but the problem was there was never nothing between me and the next drink. I didn't have any recovery. I didn't have any spirituality. It was just the committee. And I always, hey! I'm going to get the woo people out here in a minute. There you go. But so that, there was nothing between me and the next drink, and I'd always drink again. I got arrested for a 50 WI, and that started my journey into to incarceration again. And I had to go, I knew I had to go to treatment. I signed myself into a treatment center. And all I was consumed about for 90 days was the fact that I was going to have to go to court trial over all this stuff. And it consumed my life. But in AA, we had this thing called spiritual mathematics. And 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 4 in the game of spirit. So God had other plans for my life. I got a lot of breaks, a lot of opportunities, and I didn't have to go back. And I got a second chance at life. That's the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. You only get to live once, you get to live twice. And I got a chance to do that. And so I started my journey in AA. But I came into AA just like I did everything else. On my terms, my way. If you didn't like it, screw you. That was pretty much my MO coming into AA. So I survived on the fellowship for 3 years, and then I eventually crashed and burned. I was 25 years old. I was living in the basement of a house. I didn't have a car. I didn't have a driver's license. I had a dead-end job. I didn't have an education. I quit school when I was 13. I didn't even have a GED. I had a criminal record. My life sucked every which way you could take it. Just take the word sucks, highlight it, italicize it, bold it, put up in lights, and that's where my life was at after 3 years of recovery. I hated it. But I finally broke down and I did what they asked us to do. I asked for sponsorship in my life, and I started that journey in the steps, and it changed my life. And right out the gate, my sponsor told me two things. He goes, Harold, I want you doing two things all the time. I want you going somewhere, or I want you working with a new guy all the time, right back to what David was sharing, and I want you going somewhere once a week where you don't want to end up. And that's where that journey started for me. And it started in the Salvation Army Harbor Light in the Skid Row Mission. So on every Thursday night, every Saturday morning, that's where I would go. I would go into those down to the Salvation Army Harbor Light and start AA. And that, believe me, that is the toughest place I've ever done Alcoholics Anonymous. But I guess it prepared me for the next journey, because in 1993, I got a phone call that said, hey, man, we'd love for you to come out to this penitentiary and share your story. And I said, do you know who you're talking to, man? I go, yeah, we know who you're talking to. Why don't you come out to this prison? I said, well, one, I don't think they're going to let me come in there. But two, even if they said yes, I don't think I want to come. You know, I don't know. I'm too interested. And they said, well, you've been off paper long enough. I think they'll let you come in. But two, that last part of it, why don't you talk to your sponsor and get back to me? So we know how that went, right? He actually went with me. So I went out and I did the talk. And it was a great experience. And then they invited me to come to this mid-state of Missouri to the behind the walls and do a program there that the inmates actually put on. And it's what grabbed me into AA. And they asked me shortly after that, along with my buddy Henry, they said, would you two be willing to start a meeting in this maximum security prison that we really need help in that area? And so we agreed to do that. We started that meeting. We've been doing prison meetings in a maximum security for the last 20 years. You know, and that's what I do every Tuesday night. And the cool part about that is in the room, is that the guys that do that prison meeting with me are here. My buddy Frank's here. My buddy Larry's here. But what's even better is that one of the beauties, the return on your investment, if you want to call it that, is when you do this stuff long enough and you carry the message like David was talking about with guys on the inside. We're in a max facility, so we walk a long time with the guys on the inside. But when they get the journey home and come out and live the dream, live the life that we've always wanted to have, that's a beautiful thing. And I got a couple of those guys in the room tonight, but my buddy Mark sitting right back there. So the challenge is in corrections. I owe really my education to corrections, to actually doing it, but my sponsor's Tom I. For a lot of you guys know Thomas, so he was my sponsor and has been for many, many years, and so I have a great education under him. But I want to thank the North Carolina AA Committee, because it is the foundation of North Carolina AA that's really changed my life and set the stage for AA really across the nation in a lot of places. So let's give it up for North Carolina, because they got it going on. They have a conference that they put on down in North Carolina every March called Freedom from Bondage. And if you never had a chance to go to that, man, put that on your calendar and a must-do. It's the granddaddy of them all in corrections. It's only really grassroots people engaged in corrections. It will change your life, and it will fire you up if you're in corrections. So put that on your calendar and go for it. It's awesome. Good stuff. So the challenges in corrections, I think, number one, you have to know the demographics of who you're dealing with. I mean, we're alcoholic, but you can go into any prison. I've been to a lot of them all over the country. I've had a chance to do AA in a lot of places. You can go into any prison and grab me 100 guys. I don't care how old they are, what color they are, how tall they are, how short they are. And I can tell you three things about them right out the gate. Number one, their relationship with their heavenly or their earthly father is probably, there's a lot of periods of absenteeism, big gaps, or it's a poor definition altogether, for the most part. And that's 90, 95%. There's a hole in their soul and it's in the shape of a dad. You want to put it that way. Their relationship, education-wise, is below par. You know, with reading, comprehension, writing, below par. And the relationship with God is twisted at best. And that's the demographics of most guys that you pull into the institution. It's just the way it is. Other thing you got to realize is that the guys that you're listening to, and this is the same with the ladies in the institutions, that your demographics are simply this. You have a group of people. This is AA as a whole. But in the institution setting, it's really big time. You have a group of people that listen with their eyes and think with their feelings. And they listen with their eyes and think with their feelings. So for a long time, their message to you, is, and David touched on it, is going to be your example. You walking in and just your commitment, and they're going to eye you up, and they're going to measure you up, and they're going to see your trust. As Frank just come in a few years ago and started doing AA with us. And I said, Frank, it's going to be 6 months before you have the experience that you see me having in this place. And that's just a fact. It ain't because I'm special. I've been doing it for 20 years. But just hang in there. And it's almost 6 months. And now he's just one of the guys, and they love him to death. And it's a great institution. So it's a great deal. So those are your challenges going into these institutions. The other thing is that the program recovery, and David did a great job, just kept coming back to it, is the 12 steps. The 12 steps is what changes our hearts. It's what changes our minds. It's what changes our lives. So no matter what institutional setting I'm in, whether it's a county jail, whether it's a six-month facility, whether it's a medium security, or if it's a maximum security, the question I got to sit down as a person helping facilitate AA in there is, how do I engage these people in the steps in the amount of time I'm going to have to spend with them? Some people are going to have a revolving door, and almost every week it's a different group of people coming in, or every 30 days, or every 90 days. Then you got our class, which we have them for years. You know, we literally spend years. And so after about 3 years of doing corrections work in a max facility, Henry and I and a few others, we sit down, we just took an inventory. Actually, Tom challenged us to it. And he challenged us to this one inventory, and it's on effectiveness. He wanted us to look at our corrections work and ask ourselves this question: how effective have we really been in carrying this message? So when we did the inventory, we had to be really honest with ourselves and say, we have a great meeting. We have some great coffee. We got a lot of positions filled. We have a lot of enthusiasm. But where we were really hurting was that we weren't engaging these guys in the steps, really getting into the steps. So as a result of that, we worked together, and four or five of us wrote a 12-step workshop. We wrote specifically for prisons. And we did that in the late 90s, and we instituted that, and it changed everything. And that's what we continue to do today. You know, Frank and I got two different workshops going on right now, one in the Honor Center and one in our MAX facility. And that's what we'll do Tuesday night when we get back to our community. That's what we'll be engaged in, is those workshops, because that's how we take the guys through the steps. And that's what changes their lives. My buddy Mark, he's sitting back there. He got transferred into our institution right in the middle of one of our workshops. And he came in with the delusion that, you know, on step eight, that he couldn't really do a step eight because he was behind the walls, that it was some kind of false, you know, put on, and it wasn't authentic. It wasn't a legit opportunity to work the steps, which was delusional. And we were able to get him to, you know, to take actions he didn't believe in. He wrote an A step out, and his mom was number one on that list, and he became willing to reach out to that. So he hadn't talked to his mom in years, and he reached out to her behind the walls and sent her a letter, said, hey, can we do this A step? Or he wanted to visit with her. And his brother put together the funds to bring his mom all the way into town and put her in a hotel so they could spend the weekend together. So he went that week. He came back the next week, changed the guy's life. He ain't never been the same. He did the A step, did the ninth step with his mom, rock and roll. Changed his life. And he says, I want to write about it. I go write about it. So he wrote about it, and he put it in the grapevine. December 2009, Mark's story with his mom's in the grapevine, Alcoholics Anonymous. Pretty cool story. And so that's AA. Man. So I think those are the biggest challenges. Number one, knowing your demographics. You got three. It's a three-legged stool in the prison system. You have the administration. You have the volunteers, us, and then you have the offender population. And I just really talk. I just refer to them as AA members on the inside. I never call them offenders, and they're just no different than you or I. So that's always referring. But it's a three-legged stool, and if one of those stools is broken, the whole thing collapses. So there has to be great communication with the administration. You have to have a quality AA meeting going on, a group. We have a strong three-legacy group. We got all the positions filled. We got a grapevine rep. We got it all going on inside our institution. If you came to our group, and there's been some guys in the room, Carl's one of them, has come to the group, participated in our group. I mean, it's a three-legacy AA group. It's no different than, like David was talking about, going to a meeting on the outside of the institution. It's a phenomenal thing. It's a fun part to be an experience of. And then it's us as volunteers bringing the meeting into AA, is that we're dependable, we're reliable. And the million-dollar question is, am I creating an environment where people are changing their lives? Is people being able to work the 12 steps and have the spiritual experience that we've all had privilege to do on the outside that's changed our life? And that's always the inventory. Whether you're going into a treatment center or wherever, that's always the question. Do we have that quality type of recovery going on? So that's something we're always constantly looking at, always stepping back. Is that what's happening? We just had a guy just 2 weeks ago came to my home group. A matter of fact, this sponsor's here, and David was alluding to this. How do we bridge that gap? Because the first 24 to 48 hours coming out of any institution is the most important time of your life. It'll make or break the entire situation, that first 24 to 48 hours. I mean, if you don't engage recovery, by that time the dark side will sweep in. Big old limo will roll out a red carpet, tell you to deserve a little bit of the world. You're going to go, that sounds great. You'll get people to co-sign that and off to the races again. Very good chance you won't find recovery. So that first 24 to 48 hours is critical. We have a thing called bridging the gap, and it's been used inside correctional facilities. I just haven't been a huge fan of it, just to be honest, because of the accountability part of it. That if, once all these numbers and communications transferred, that there just isn't a lot of accountability to that. So we really, I mean, for me, it's simply if you're on the inside and we want to work the steps with you, you want to sponsor, we hook you up with somebody from the outside. You know, and somebody that I know personally, it's in a geographical area where you're at. So there's accountability. I know you're talking to them, and I know you're talking to them in relationships here. My buddy Mike's here, and I asked him if he would sponsor this guy several years ago. The guy was doing life sentence, and he agreed to do that. I'm talking several years ago, and he got on the writing penmanship, and eventually he got on his visitor list and started working the steps. 2 weeks ago on Wednesday, I'm down in the hall getting ready to help set up the A meeting. I see this goofy-looking face in the window, and it's Mike. And I'm like, what's he doing sneaking in the side door? And what's he doing at my meeting anyway? He never comes here. And I go open the door, and lo and behold, our buddy Scott comes walking in right behind him. Scott just got out doing 20 years, you know, flat. And he's out today, and that's a great sponsor. That's sponsorship for the steps. So being able to try to make those connections and engage that, so that first 24 to 48 hours, I think is one of the biggest challenges we all face in this program. How do we do that? And that's how I've been able to try to do it and do it successfully, and it's worked. It's worked well. So that, you know, those are the big ones for me. That's always the big ones. But the key thing is that most people I know, and there's a lot of people that I love and respect in corrections sitting in this room right now, once you get into corrections, it's hard to kick you out. You know, it really is. I mean, I'm fortunate our Eastern Area Corrections Chair is in the room tonight. You know, we have the strongest AA in our Area 38 that I've seen in my 28 years of sobriety. And that's really, again, a filter down from the North Carolina influence that it's had on our area. I mean, I put Area 38 corrections up against any area in the United States. It's that strong of an AA today. The communication we have up and down the pipe and even spilling over into Area 39 in the Western area. It's powerful stuff. It's fun to be a part of that today in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll share a few highlights of recovery that I just have been blessed with inside the institution, and then I'll be down and we'll listen to Rick talk. In 2001, September 11th, happened on a Tuesday. And that Saturday, we had our annual banquet. We in this particular institution, we used to bring an AA banquet, and we bring in speakers, and then we'd have a softball game. Us volunteers, AA members, against the guys on the inside. So we show up to this deal, and we end up lining up on the baselines. We had all of us on the AA outsiders on the third baseline and all the people on the inside on the first baseline. And everybody was emotionally a wreck. I mean, 9/11 affected all of us big time. I mean, everybody was just jacked with that. And this guy who's on their team walks out in a fender with a trumpet. And, man, he played taps. And he's talking about, I mean, the whole prison population sitting there watching the game. You know, there's hundreds of people there. And we're all just bawling our brains out. And here we are in a maximum security penitentiary, man. It was just amazing, amazing thing to be a part of. We don't typically bring in women speakers, and Henry's wife at the time, you know, Henry said, I'm going to bring her in and let her share. So we told the guys, we're going to bring this lady in. We want you guys on your best behavior. They said, we'll be all right. True story, man. We walk into the meeting that night, and these guys had taken paper and made ties out of paper. They had them all clipped on and all decked out for the meeting, and it blew me away, man. It blew me away. We called the AA community and we said, hey, we get to bring cookies in. Can some of you people make cookies? Well, all, especially the ladies, stood up. And we had bags and bags and bags of cookies we brought into this prison. And, of course, being the thieves they are, they all pocketed a bunch of them. And they're trading them for smokes and who knows what else. And we get written up the following week. You know, we're doing all that crap. It's been an amazing ride. I got more. Just a couple quick stories. One offender in particular, his name is Brent, and Brent come to our meeting. This is just how AA works. He came to our group in 1996, one of those guys that was listening to his eyes, you know, or listening with his eyes and thinking with his feelings. And he came to the meeting, he sat like this for 6 months, didn't even talk to us. And finally, he got the courage to speak up, and immediately he signed up for a workshop. He worked at 12 steps, and it changed his life. He was doing two life sentences. Didn't know when he's ever going to go home. But he was engaged, and I watched the 12 steps change this guy's heart, change this guy's life. And little by little, I mean, he got a 4-year setback, a 5-year setback, a 2-year setback. And eventually he got transferred out of my institution. Then he got transferred back to another institution that I was at. And one day he walks into the institution. He had a big old grin that wrapped all the way around his head like this. And I said, what are you so happy about? He goes, dude, I got an out date. I said, what? He says, I got an outtake. I mean, he should have done at least 20 years on each one. He should have done at least 30 years. But he ended up doing 21 years to the day. But he was so excited, and he come home, and he called me. He did exactly what he's supposed to do. He called me immediately. He says, man, I'm on this thing called a cell phone. It's crazy, man. I said, well, great, man. Well, just call me again tomorrow. So he calls me the next morning. He says, hey, man, you're going to never guess what I've been doing. And I said, well, let's see. You've been incarcerated for 21 years. You haven't been with your wife in 21 years. I can guess what you've been doing on that. He laughs. He goes, no, man, I'm not talking about all that. And I go, what are you talking about? He goes, man, I've been opening gifts. And I go, what kind of gifts, man? Welcome home gifts? He goes, no, man, I've been opening Father's Day gifts, birthday gifts, and Christmas gifts for the last 21 years. Amazing stuff, man. Crazy. And he's doing good today. His wife is really struggling health-wise. But Brent's still a rock star in our community. One time, you know, what's crazy about that is when he came on, I said, well, somebody gave me a gift to give you. I said, actually, after he told me that story, he goes, and you're never going to guess what I got for Christmas in 97. And I said, what did you get for 97? And he goes, I got a Miami's Dolphin jacket. He's a Miami Dolphins fan. And I said, well, hey, a guy knew that you love the Dolphins, and he gave me 4 tickets to give to you to watch the Dolphins play the Rams in 4 weeks here in St. Louis. He couldn't believe it. He says, who am I going to take? I said, you take whoever you want. He says, well, I'm going to take you, we'll take Big Book Bob, and we'll take Gary. All these guys got sober in 96 in the prison group. All of them had life sentences or more. Gary had life sentence, and Bob had life in 45. But here we are all sitting at this football game, watching this game, having the time of our life. Ain't that crazy? And at halftime, the people turn around, and the lady sitting in front of us turned around, and she goes, man, at halftime, she goes, you guys are having a lot of fun. I said, yeah. She goes, you guys aren't even drinking. I said, I know. She goes, well, it's a good thing. And I said, why is that? She says, you guys probably end up in jail the way you guys are. But it's just crazy. But it's fun. I mean, the 20 years, I get to sit up here all day and just share stories after stories after stories of the ride that being involved in corrections is at. Probably something I do for the rest of my life. It's really a passion that I have, and it's a gift. And I've literally worked with zillions of guys over the years as a result of it. And it's been a privilege and honor to be a part of corrections. If you're even thinking about getting in corrections, I hope that you take that challenge. And Carol said it best right off the bat. And David even mentioned it, and it's so true. It isn't about being a criminal. It's about taking the gift of sobriety and carrying it to those on the inside. You know, and as it tells us on page 24, our dark past can be our greatest asset, you know, and with it we can avert misery and death for those behind the walls, and it's a game changer. We're just a conduit, you know, that goes in there. But it's amazing what God will do with all that. Just absolutely incredible, incredible, incredible ride. So I hope if you haven't done that, that you get engaged with that, you become a part of that. We're having some fun in our prison right now. We're doing a remake with GSO of Sure Beats Sitting in a Cell, a 25-year-old DVD. That if you go to GSO website, go to full length videos, you can watch the old one. But we're right in the middle of doing the new one. And part of it we've done in North Carolina with our friends in North Carolina. And the last part we're doing it where I go to the prison at. And we're just finishing up, and we'll be doing the video portion of that on next Tuesday and Wednesday night. And at my home group next Wednesday night will be the guys in charge of corrections for North America, Clement. He'll be there sharing it. And that guy I just told you that I just got out of prison, Scotty, he'll be our other speaker in our group on Wednesday night. Corrections is awesome. It's been awesome for me. I know it'll be awesome for you if you're not engaged in it, or if maybe you're one of those people that was and now you faded out. But I hope you come back. Get a part of this thing. We need you. They need you. It's an awesome thing. So thanks a lot for letting me be a part.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic. While I saw these people walking out the door, I didn't know that there were that many people here that had heard me speak before. You laugh now. My name's Rick. Like I said, I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Greensburg Sunday Night 12 and 12. It's in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. My sobriety date is June 23rd of 2002. I do have a big book, and I do have a sponsor. And I have worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with my sponsor. You know, it's funny, AA is amazing to me. Ava Sanchez and I got to communicate back and forth. Started with a phone call to the GSO one day, and you know, my wife and I, we flew in here Saturday, and last Saturday, and you know, I told Ava one day, we were talking on the phone, I said, you know, I'm going to be down there early. If you, you know, if you need some help, you know, let me know. And I'm thinking setting up chairs. You know, Ava, she doesn't think like me, obviously. And I got the email one day sitting at work, and I almost peed my pants, to be honest with you. It was really, I was really excited, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be here today. You know, we'll start out. You know, I when I first came to AA, I was fresh out of rehab, and one of the things that I kept hearing in rehab was, you know, the old 90 meetings in 90 days. And, you know, I always say that that was very important to me because, you know, they told me I only had a 20% chance I'd ever drink again. So I I liked the odds. And I started doing the 90 and 90. And, you know, it was really important for me at that point because I was excited. I was excited that I had learned that there was a solution to my drinking problem. And I learned that in rehab. You know, I could never figure this drinking thing out. You know, one of the things sitting in those 90 meetings that I kept hearing over and over and over again was about doing service work. You know, the three sides of the triangle, and you know, if you wanted to get sober and stay sober, how you had to have balance, recovery in all three areas. And a funny story. So I my sponsor had me join this 12 and 12 group as a home group because that was somewhere where his sponsor was a home group member. And there was a good sponsorship family there, and it was important that we, you know, we got into the 12 and 12 book. And there was a guy in that home group by the name of Tony. And I think at the time I was about, I can't even really say, probably 5 or 6 months sober. And he was the district grapevine representative. And he made an announcement in a meeting one night that he needed an assistant. A helper. And so after the meeting, I went up to him and I say, Tony, you know, if you need some help, I talked to my sponsor and, you know, he said, it's okay. You know, I can be your helper. And he looked at me and he said, well, how long have you been sober? And I said, 5 or 6 months. And he said, well, I don't know. He said, yeah, I don't know if you have enough sober time. And I got mad. I said, what the hell's the matter with this guy? You know, he's sitting in here asking for help, and then I want to help, and then now he's telling me no. You know, I'm thinking, this AA, these guys, they're screwy in here, you know. Well, anyway, so as it ended up, he went back to the next district meeting, and he brought it up in front of the, you know, in the district, at the district level, and, you know, one of the guys told him there, he said, you know, if you got a horse, put a saddle on him and ride him, you know, so... That following Sunday, he came back to the meeting, and, you know, he told me the news, and I was pretty excited about it. And that was my first service job. But, you know, it's very important. You know, my talk today, I don't have a lot of experience so much with the corrections as I, you know, so I'm trying to blend you know, my challenges in working in corrections and the theme of this, you know, the conference here that, you know, the happy, joyous, and free theme. And, you know, today, I mean, I am not happy, joyous, and free every day, but I'm happy, joyous, and free most of the days. And I believe that that's because I do try to have a balanced recovery. And, you know, the reason I want to talk about how I got my first service job, and my home group back home, the Sunday night 12 and 12, my buddy Todd's sitting back there, and I was going to use a little quote of his from a day of sharing back about 10 years ago, but there's a lot of women here, so I'm not going to say it. But we do have a really great home group, and we are very it's been very educational as far as Alcoholics Anonymous is concerned, teaching me to be a good member of AA and an ambassador. And we do a lot of service work. And one of the things that we do there is, well, it started out when I was first joined the home group, that once a year we would do it. And now it seems like it's, I think we've been doing it now twice a year. But we also take a meeting into a mental health facility that's near our home group. And it's called Torrance State Hospital. And I actually we use that as the my sponsorship family. We use that as a kind of a training camp for doing a lead. You know, when you get, after you do your fifth step and you're ready to do your first lead, well, they drag us to Torrance. You know, because, well, it's a mental health facility, and they figure, you know, it's a pretty soft audience. So you know, but. So I went up there to do my first lead, and you know, it was quite an experience. But you know, when you do service work and you do go into places like that, institutions and prisons, and you know, you never really, you know, one of the challenges that I found is you know, am I doing any good? You know, now we've heard a lot of success stories here about, you know, what our service work can do, but you know, a guy like me who you know, is still alcoholic and you know, is always questioning, you know, this guy that's on the inside, you know. But I did this lead at Torrance, and a couple months later, I was standing outside a meeting, and this little lady came up to me, and she has since passed away, but her name was Lisa P. And she was one of us, and she came up to me after the meeting, and she said, she gave me a wristband, a little blue wristband, and she said, "Here, I want to give this to you, and so you'll remember me." And and I said, "I'm sorry." I said, "Who are you?" And she said, "Well, you probably don't remember me, but I was in Torrance one night when you did your lead." And she said, "I want to thank you." She said, "Because you know, since you've been there, I've been able to, you know, get sober and stay sober, and I got my children back." So. You know, I was at a meeting yesterday, and there was a lady talking, and she got kind of choked up, and she started crying while she was talking. And I'm thinking to myself, I know exactly what that's like, because I think every time I speak, that happens to me. So if I start crying, don't get worried about it. I'll be okay. I'm used to it. But anyway, you know, that was another service, you know, story that I had. And, you know, as my, as I, you know, continue on this journey, you know, I've gone into different things, and I've ended up that, you know, I do a meeting at the Westmoreland County prison, which is in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, where I grew up. And, you know, I've been doing that meeting the third Friday of every month for, I don't know, I've been sober 13 years. I don't know exactly how long it's been, but it's been somewhere eight to 10 years, somewhere in there, that I've, you know, so much for the spirit of rotation. but, you know, like Harold said, you know, once they get you into that prison system, you know, it's hard to get out, you know. They, but I enjoy it. And, you know, I was, talking to my grand sponsor about, you know, the challenges of correction, you know, and the challenges for me in anything in life, whether it's my job, my family, taking meetings into corrections, you know, or whatever it is, seem to all be the same. And they're all, being an alcoholic, they're all created in my head. You know, what the true challenges are, you know, I don't know. Sometimes the people, the administrators in the prisons, they don't necessarily do things the way that I think that they should. But what I have to continue to understand is that, you know, they're administrators, and that's their job, and they do what they do, hopefully to the best of their ability. What I have to remember is that today, and, you know, we heard somebody say about always doing the next right thing, I made a commitment. 8, 10 years ago, whenever it was, I made a commitment to take a meeting into that prison on the third Friday of every month. My job is to suit up and show up. Whether the COs are having a bad day and they don't get the guys together for the meeting, and instead of having 15 guys, I only have 2, or sometimes I have none, which doesn't always make me happy after driving over there after work on a Friday night, but, you know, that's okay too. But I, you know, I have to just stay focused on what my responsibilities are. And we have a responsibility statement in Alcoholics Anonymous that says, you know, anytime, you know, anywhere someone reaches out for help, that we want the hand of AA to always be there, and that we are responsible for. So, so that's where I have to stay focused. I have to remember, you know, what my purpose is. You know, I the first time I ever had handcuffs put on me, I was 12 years old. You know, my wife's here. She's never heard me speak before, so I may say a few things. You know, I might be getting divorced on Monday. I just got to keep trying to tell the truth, you know. You know, I've always had, you know, I hate to say it, but I've always had a criminal mind. You know, I was a thief. I mean, I was a thief when I was 9 years old. You know, I just got lucky. I didn't get caught till I was 12. You know, but you know, I used to make a lot of bad decisions, and you know, I like we all do. But you know, I would get arrested, and you know, somehow I would get out of it. You know, and that seemed to be the routine. And I guess because of that, you know, the fear of getting arrested really didn't exist in my life, because I thought some way, you know, I'd get out of it like I always did. But later on in life, I found out that things change, you know, and sometimes you don't get away with things. But I was incarcerated a few times for short periods of time, and so I've had that prison experience, but I haven't been a long-term resident or anything like that. But, you know, there's always, when I got started doing the prison thing, there was always a place in my heart for those people that have the criminal mind, because I'm one of them. And, you know, I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, there is a way out, and there's a solution to our problem if alcohol is the reason that we're there. You know, so I want to be able to let those people know that there is a solution, and there is hope for people that think the way that I think, that you know, you can, it's, you know, you can change your way of thinking, you know, and you know, and that's important, because, you know, nobody, you know, the alcoholic, there's nobody that understands us except us. you know, the administrators, the corrections officers, the counselors, you know, whoever, you know, these guys come in contact with day in and day out, they don't know. They don't understand. They're, you know, it's got to be what Alcoholics Anonymous was built on. It's got to be one alcoholic talking to another, because that's the, you know, and people that I found that are incarcerated, you know, there's a definite lack of trust there that, you know, we don't trust anybody. I mean, you know, and it's important to be able to sit down with somebody and not look down on them and not, you know, like they're, you know, like they have some communicable disease or something, that, you know, and let them know that, you know, tell them my story and let them understand that, yeah, I think just like you do. And you know, but in this book, you know, and we, one thing about our little district that we have back home, we have a H&I pink can. I don't know if you guys do that where you're from or not, but we pass that at meetings, and it's for money strictly for literature. And I think the last 3 years in a row, our district, we've been able to collect over $10,000 per year for literature so that these guys that are incarcerated, they have the literature. They have the big books. They have the 12 and 12s. They have the daily reflections, the as Bill sees it, you know, we try to. There's a lot of short-term people that this prison that I go into, the maximum sentence is 23 months. So these guys are, you know, there's a revolving door in there. And if nothing else, you know, inside the cover of those books is our District 23 answering service number, so that these guys, you know, Harold mentioned bridging the gap. Well, back where we are, bridging the gap doesn't work very well either. So, you know, there's got to be some other way for these guys to reach out to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, our 800 number is stamped right inside the cover of that book, so that those guys, they can find us once they get on the outside. So the literature and the donation in a pink can is very important, I believe, in our district for what we do. But, you know, it, you know, the things that, you know, I've probably thought about what I was going to say when I got up here. You know, I don't know how long it's been since I got that email. It's 2, 3, 4 months ago, I guess. And, you know, I've written a couple thousand speeches in my head. And, you know, the good news is on the way over here today, I forgot them all. But, you know, there's so many things that, you know, that responsibility prayer comes into mind. And, you know, it's something that, and if I'm not mistaken, I think that was that the theme of the convention in San Antonio the last time, was I am responsible. Is that correct? Or was that Toronto? Toronto, was it? Okay. All right, see, my forgetter works 100% today. You know, but it all goes back to, you know, the whole process that we go through here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can only talk about my own experience. I don't know what it's really been like for anybody else, but, you know, it's all these little things that I've learned along the way, these little cliches and little quotes out of the big book that you know, the old timers, you know, they mention and they drill it into your head. You know, the one that really sticks in my mind is, you know, when I come to these internationals, it's always right after one of my anniversaries. And so I always buy myself a coin for whatever year it is, because I like these little colorful coins with Bill and Dr. Bob on them. And can everybody hear me? Okay. It's not real hard to hear me, but my wife always tells me, shh, you're talking too loud. But anyway, on the back of this coin, which I bought yesterday, and I didn't even realize it was on there because I didn't even take it out of the package till this morning, but, you know, it says on the back, and this is something that... was brought to my attention by my grand sponsor in a conversation one day about the success rate in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he mentioned to me that it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who thoroughly follows our path. And that's why it's so important. If you are in here because you're thinking about doing service work, and maybe corrections is something that you would like to get involved in, it's so important to get a job. And I think that, you know, I believe that this program is a true gift to me from my God, my higher power, because until June 23rd, 2002, when I was sitting by myself thinking that I was getting my seventh DUI, and for some reason did not, by the grace of God, I asked my higher power, who I call God, to please help me. I didn't want to live my life like that anymore. And I haven't had a drink since. And you know, it's but you know, I don't do this by myself. You know, we do it together. And that's why I look at these coins and I see that, you know, unity, you know, which is the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I see service. You know, and for some reason, when I look at this coin, I see those two things first before I see recovery. And I think it's so important that, you know, I heard it said yesterday in a meeting, you know, we all have a little niche, you know, and God has a plan for us. You know, God had a plan for me. God had a plan for each one of you. And God's plan was to get you here. Okay, so now we're here, and now what are we going to do about it? You know, that's the question you have to ask yourself. You know, what kind of service are you going to get involved in? You know, and hopefully you're here because you have an interest in corrections, because I think that that's probably one of the areas that is least common when we think about doing service work in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, those guys that are locked up, you know, I think that they're my pastor at my church, I forget what the heck he calls them, the least, the lost, and the locked up, I think, is how he always says it. You know, and like these guys said before me, those people aren't any different than I am, or probably a lot of you. It's just that, you know, their timing was bad. You know, they got caught. You know, and I did a lot of things in my life that, you know, if I would have got caught for a third of them, I'd still be incarcerated, and I probably would be for the rest of my life. But, you know, that wasn't God's plan for me. You know, God's plan for me was, you know, to eventually come here to Alcoholics Anonymous, work the steps, have a spiritual awakening as a result of those steps, and, you know, be able to do 12-step work, you know, help the next suffering alcoholic, you know. And, you know, that's what those people that are behind bars are. They're just another suffering alcoholic that probably doesn't know or doesn't understand that there's a way out for them. And, you know, we need to keep that in mind and you know, keep reaching out to these people and you know, carrying the message. You know, and when we go into these prisons, you know, not talk about the administrators or the COs or who's not doing their job. You know, remember, we're ambassadors for the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, we have to practice these principles that we learn here in all of our affairs. And that's also going inside to help those guys out wherever it may be. So I don't really know how much else I can talk about it today. I really do appreciate the opportunity to be here and to talk to you guys, and I hope that maybe I said something that might help you when you leave here. And I want to thank all my friends that came to listen to me speak from back home. Give yourselves a hand back there. And I want to thank the committee for asking me, and thank these guys that came before me, and Carol for chairing the meeting. And God bless you all. Thank you.